All right. Well, hello again to those of you who have already heard me say hello a couple of times. This is Jim Pickett with IRMA, the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. Thank you for joining the call, the evolution and implementation of MTN-017, put on by IRMA and our friends at AVAC. Thank you very much, AVAC, for your support of this call. Today we will have two presenters. We'll be starting with Ross Cranston, who is with the MTN and a protocol chair for 017, and he's going to take us through really the title of the talk, Evolution and Implementation of 017. And then we're going to be joined by Ian McGowan, a co-principal investigator of the Microbicide Trials Network, who's going to start talking us through what the future of rectal microbicide studies look like post-phase two, looking at planning and design issues for a phase three. I just want to note that just a few years ago, all of this, to many people, maybe not a lot of people on this call, but to many people outside of this call, and certainly other people in the field, this idea would seem was preposterous to actually be thinking about having a phase three, to even consider that a rectal microbicide could be developed that was both safe and effective, was just seen as, you know, impossible biologically, and people just weren't interested in it. Of course, not the people on this call, and certainly not Ross and Ian, who have been long champions of the rectal compartment. So just want to note that it wasn't that long ago that we wouldn't have considered, or most people weren't considering, rectal microbicide research other than it being an adjunct to vaginal studies, and that we had to have some safety data in the rectum before we completely move forward with the vaginal product. These days it's much different, and we're actually even talking now about products that work in both locations. So really exciting, definitely evolution and revolution. So with that said, I am going to turn over the mic to Ross Cranston, who is going to take us through the background and update on MTN-017. So go ahead, Ross.
Thank you very much, Jim. Good morning, everyone from Pittsburgh. It's always a pleasure to talk about 017, and I think it's particularly timely to talk about 017 now, as we really have our eyes on the prize. We are hoping to complete this study this year, and I think it's as I said, timely just to kind of review how we got here, why we're even doing this study, and then I'm going to pass it over to Ian, who will let us know what the potential plans are for the future. So thank you very much to IRMA and AVAC for the invite. Right, let's go to the next slide. So as we know, it takes a village, and this is the 017 team, who I am incredibly and daily grateful for, as they're doing really a fantastic job of this incredibly complicated and difficult to manage study. My job has been easy. This team are great, and it's been relatively seamless. So I really want to take my hat off to the team just before we start. So let's go on to slide number three. So this is 017. It is, just to go through it, it's a phase two, it's a randomized sequence, open label, expanded safety and acceptability study of oral FTC tenofovir and rectally applied tenofovir gel in the reduced glycerin formulation. So this is safety and acceptability. It's not an effectiveness study, and that's important to realize before we go on to the next slide. So these are our study products. We have two products. We have oral FTC tenofovir, Truvada, which is manufactured by Gilead Sciences, and 1% tenofovir in a reduced glycerin formulation, which is manufactured by Conrad. So what I'd like to do is really just spend a little bit of time talking about why we chose these products, and then how we will plan to use them in the study. Next slide, please. The evolution of FTC tenofovir really was IPREX. So IPREX, which was conducted by Bob Grant, international study, phase three multi-center study of 2,500 HIV-negative, men of sex with men, and transgender women, who were randomized either to receive placebo or FTC-tenofovir. There was a follow-up of around 1.2 years, and the primary endpoints in this study were adverse events and also HIV seroconversion. Next slide. And I'm sure everyone knows, this really was a pivotal study. It showed 44% effectiveness of the intervention to reduce the incidence of HIV infection. This in the context of only, well, I say only, but 50% adherence to product. And that's critical, and that's something which I'll come back to later. In the diagram, you can see that placebo is represented in red and FTC-tenofovir presented in blue. And as time went on, you can see an increase in HIV seroconversions in the placebo group and the reduction or the decreased seroconversions in the FTC-tenofovir group. This, of course, led to this study led to the licensure of Truvada in the U.S. for oral PrEP. So this is seroconversion. Let's have a look at adverse events on the next slide. So there was no significant differences between the active and the placebo arms for any grade 3 or 4 adverse events. So these are severe adverse events. Death, SAE means severe adverse events. We know that tenofovir has some renal complications, and so the study looked particularly at creatinine, which is a marker of renal function, and not only creatinine, but creatinine which was persistently elevated, and found that neither of those two were significantly different between the two groups. The two adverse events that were significantly different were nausea and weight decrease. So both of these were more common in the active intervention, the FTC-tenofovir arms. Now, weight decrease, I think, is as yet unexplained, but the next slide will have a look at nausea. So next slide, please. And you can see here that the nausea was much more common in the FTC-tenofovir group in the first month or so. Now, that should be no surprise to anyone who uses FTC-tenofovir either as something which is prescribed or a prescriber treating a patient with HIV infection using FTC-tenofovir as part of triple therapy. So this is an extremely common side effect that happens initially, and as you can see here, as the participants in this study continued to take the FTC-tenofovir, the prevalence of nausea was pretty much the same as placebo, so really only an issue in the first month. Right, let's go on to the next slide, and I'm going to talk about the evolution of the gel formulation. So just a little bit of background. Before all of this started, we've certainly taken a lot of our cues from the vaginal microbicide group, and in particular, the Caprice 004 study. So this was conducted by Slim Abdul Karim and his team in sub-Saharan Africa, in women, and the women in this study, they used 1% tenofovir gel, which was formulated for the vagina, and they used it before and after sex. And in that study, there was a signal of protection, 39% of the women on the intervention, not on the placebo, there was a reduction of 39% in terms of HIV seroconversion. So we've translated this in the RMP02 and MCN006 study. This was an incredibly complicated study for everyone involved, investigators and participants, and I want to take you just to describe this study. So I'm going to go from left to right on the slide. So participants, both men and women, came into the study and had a baseline evaluation. They then received an open-label tablet of tenofovir, one tablet of tenofovir. After that tablet, they had safety assessments, and they had PK and PD. Now, PK means we looked at the concentration of tenofovir in various different body compartments. PD means pharmacodynamics, and what that means is we looked at the effect of tenofovir on the body, which I'll talk to in a bit more detail just in a few slides' time. We also had to look, we were interested in looking at acceptability of in this case, the tablet initially, and then the gel. So after these assessments were done, there was a washout period, and the participants then received one single tenofovir rectal gel application. This was randomized, 2-to-1, so 18 participants received tenofovir gel, vaginal formulation, and 6 participants received placebo. They then had the same assessments, and then there was a washout period, and then they had 7 daily applications of this gel or placebo, and again, the same assessments. So let's see what we found in terms of adverse events, and that's on the next slide. Now, clearly, we're placing gel into the gastrointestinal tract. We're particularly interested in GI side effects. And you can see here that it was really not very pretty. The adverse events which these participants described were abdominal pain, rectal urgency, which means, you know, the need to go to the bathroom, bloating, nausea, diarrhea, and flatulence. And these were occurring in almost 50% of our participants. So clearly, this is not an ideal product portfolio for anyone who would potentially be using this in the context of receptive anal sex. So bearing that in mind, I want to just backtrack a little bit and talk about PD. So this is pharmacodynamics, the effects of tenofovir on the body. These studies are very, very early studies. So what we wanted to get was a kind of a signal to see if could this intervention potentially work. So this is an experimental study. What happened was, we going from left to right on the slide, we took some rectal tissue. So we used a flexible sigmoidoscope. We took some rectal tissue biopsies, and you can see there was little kind of pink things floating in the pink fluid there. We then placed them on a raft in the lab and exposed these little bits of rectum to HIV in the lab. Now remember, two-thirds of these rectal biopsies had been exposed to tenofovir. One-third had not been exposed. So we wanted to see if the tenofovir-exposed group, did the tenofovir protect those little bits of rectal tissue? So how we do this is we keep those little bits of rectum alive for 14 days, and we look in that pink fluid for something called P24. Now, if a piece of rectum gets infected with a lab strain of HIV, then it produces P24. So if the tissue is infectable, then we see 24. If the tissue is protected by tenofovir, then we don't see P24. So let's go on to the next slide. Now, this graph shows exactly what we found, and it's a complicated graph. I'm going to go through it from the top down. The gray dot represents the oral dose of tenofovir, which participants took. Red dot, single rectal dose of tenofovir, and the blue dot is the multiple rectal doses, so the 7 rectal doses, and they were assessed at the end of the 7 doses. Now, on the left-hand side of the graph, on the y-axis, you see the amount of P24. So left 24, P24 at the bottom, high levels of 24 at the top. On the x-axis, you see the amount of tenofovir in tissue. So on the left-hand side, not very much tenofovir. On the right-hand side, lots of tenofovir. And you can see that the slope of the curve goes down. Now, that's important because if there is less tenofovir, then there's more to P24, which means that the biopsies got infected. However, if there was more tenofovir in the tissues, then there was less chance that those tissues would get infected with the lab strain of HIV. So here we have a really optimistic signal that actually the intervention, the placement of tenofovir in the rectum, could potentially protect the rectum from incident infection with HIV within the lab. So let's go on to the next slide. Now, I've mentioned all of these gastrointestinal side effects, adverse events, and we obviously asked the participants what they thought about it, and they didn't like it very much, clearly. So only 25% said that they liked the tenofovir gel very much, compared to 50% who liked the placebo. This was clearly not going to be something which we could progress forward because of all of those adverse events. Now, we thought that the reason why the adverse events were occurring was not because of the tenofovir. It was the osmolality, or the concentration of the gel that the tenofovir was formulated into. And we thought that the culprit for this was the amount of glycerin in the gel. So Conrad reformulated the gel, and we then had a reduced glycerin formulation. So to give you an idea of osmolality, the osmolality of the gel is about 3,000. Our body tissues are about 300, and the osmolality of the reduced formulation is about 800. So we're getting there. Let's go to the next slide and MTN-007. So this is using the reduced glycerin formulation in this study. So again, let me take you through it from left to right. So participants, men and women, came in for screening. This time we had four arms. We introduced N9 as a positive control. N9 has been associated in previous studies in women of vaginal microbicides. It has been shown to potentially increase HIV infection, and that's been shown really to be due to the effect that it has on the rectum, which, although damages the rectum, it damages the rectum in a transient way. Remember, this is a sexually abstinent population. So we had a group who were taking N9 rectally. We then had a group who were taking the reduced glycerin formulation of tenofovir. A group took HEC placebo, and there was a group with no treatment at all. And very similar to 006, but without the oral component, they had a baseline evaluation, then assessment, they had a single dose, then assessment, and then they had seven daily doses. So let's go on to the next slide and see what happened in terms of adverse events. And clearly, there was a huge big change. All of the urgency, the bloating, the nausea was reduced to zero. We still had flatulence, which I think is interesting and may be unrelated to the formulation, but maybe actually related to the tenofovir. But this was considered a much, much better product portfolio than the previous formulation. So let's go on to the next slide. And you can see here, really side to side, the MTN-007 formulation with the MTN-006 formulation. Now, on the next slide, we asked participants what they thought of this in terms of acceptability. And not surprisingly, they liked the tenofovir much better than N9. But they also liked it in a very similar way to the HEC placebo gel. So we thought that this was clearly something which we could take forward into phase two. Now, the next slide, we're very keen to avoid any form of inflammation with anything that we put into the rectum. We know that inflammation, because it pulls T cells down to the rectum, and those T cells can accept HIV infection, we at all costs want to avoid that happening. So we looked at all of these different things to make sure that we were not causing inflammation in the rectum. And we found that we were not. But there was one interesting slide, which I'll go on to next. So this is work which was collected in 007 and actually just in the last week or so published by Florian Laddick in eLife, so you can look at it online. And what it looked at was gene array. So it's fantastically complicated, and I have a very basic understanding of this, but what this showed was, what Florian was looking for is, with all of these products, we want to know if there was upregulation or downregulation of genes within the rectal tissue. Now, we were expecting N9, the bad player in the rectum, to cause a problem, but you can see here on the table that really there was a little bit of upregulation, there was a little bit of downregulation of genes. However, tenofovir, much really to our surprise, upregulated much more and also downregulated many more genes. So we don't actually know the implications of this yet. We think it's an interesting signal, which may be important, and that's something which we will look at in more detail in MTN-017. Right, so let's actually get on to MTN-017 with the next slide. So the study population, it's very similar to IFREX, although we have 186 participants, obviously HIV uninfected, again, men who sex with men, transgender females, who report practicing receptive anal intercourse, and they're aged 18 years or older. The study duration is long. It's 27 weeks, so it's about 6 months. And we project that for each site who takes part in 017, 6 to 9 months from beginning to end. Next slide. There are three study regimes in MTN-017. We want to look at rectal tenofovir gel used daily. We also want to have a look at rectal tenofovir gel used in a similar way to Caprisa, so used before and after sex within 24 hours. And we also want to look as a comparator at oral product, FTC tenofovir tablets taken daily, similar to IPRAX. So each participant will come in and they'll be randomized to a sequence in which they will take these products, either oral or various different types of rectum, for 8 weeks. In addition to having, as with all MTN studies, a standard HIV prevention package. Next slide. So just to look at this in pictorially, at the top of the slide, we have visit one, which from left to right, visit one, which is screening. We then have the enrollment visit, and they initiate period one. They then spend 4 weeks on period one and then have a mid-period visit for safety assessments, repeat HIV testing, and then they are re-given the next lot of product, and participants take product for the next 4 weeks. So that completes period one. They then have a washout period of 1 week and then initiate period two. Now, you can see the sequence down below. What I've done is I've highlighted product sequence number one. So what happens here is that if this person is randomized to sequence number one, they would come into the study, they would take daily tenofovir FTC for eight weeks, they would then have the break, they'd then go into rectal gel, then have a break, and then have rectal gel before and after sex. Let's go on to the next slide. So what I've done here is put in the primary objectives and also the endpoints just down below. So clearly, this is an expanded safety study. We are desperate to know about safety for these three different regimes. And the way that we assess safety is by asking participants about any adverse events they experience. And there are tables which we refer to, published by the Division of AIDS, in order to assess that. We're also looking at acceptability. So clearly, we want to know how participants feel when they take the daily product, the before and after sex product, or the oral product. And we want to know particularly if it's easy to use, if you like the product, and also their likelihood of using this product should it be shown to be effective in the future. Next slide. Our secondary objective is pharmacokinetics, so PK, as I said, measuring the amount of tenofovir in different parts, in different body compartments, whether it be plasma or fluid. We also have the ability in Pittsburgh and also in Bangkok to look at rectal tissue, and we'll be assessing both tenofovir concentrations in rectal tissue and also the activated form of tenofovir diphosphate in peripheral blood mononuclear cells and also rectal tissue. As Truvada or FTC tenofovir has emphysitabine in it as well, we'll also check those concentrations. Next slide. Clearly, adherence is critical, as we've all learned from the recent VOICE data published in the New England Journal last week. And so we want to compare the percentage of prescribed doses orally or administered directly that were actually taken during that eight-week period. So next slide. That's great. So exploratory objectives. A number of exploratory objectives. So here we're looking at pharmacodynamic responses. That's in, for example, the explant tissue in Pittsburgh and also in Bangkok. We want to see if there's any changes in mucosal immunity, which would indicate inflammation, as I've said. And we also want to correlate PK, so the amount of tenofovir in tissue with adherence measures. There's also a number of behavioral objectives, which we want to try and understand if using a microbicide daily will alter or change sexual activity or condom use. Will there be any product sharing? Or will it change practices associated with anal intercourse by using this product either rectally daily or before and after sex? So let's go on to the next slide and our study sites. You can see here we have four sites within the U.S., Boston, Pittsburgh, San Juan, and San Francisco. South America, we have Lima, Peru, South Africa, Cape Town, and two sites in Thailand, both Chiang Mai and Bangkok. Next slide. Adherence has become ever more critical in microbicide studies, and we learned that when Ginny Marazzo presented this at CROI, and very quickly turned around and really changed the protocol in terms of the adherence assessments to add something called real-time PK to better assess adherence during the study and not simply wait until the study was over and then look to see if participants took or indeed didn't take the study product. So let's go to the next slide. And Alex Carballo-Diegues and his team have put together this incredibly comprehensive adherence measurement cascade, if you like. So there are various different ways that we're looking at adherence in 017. Each participant gets a daily text from Alex and his team, and they can say whether they took product or didn't take product. When they're seen at study visits, they will fill in a computer-assisted self-interview, and we'll collect data there on how many times they actually used product during the previous 4 weeks. We will also look at the pharmacy at product returns, so the participants are bringing back unused product. And then this is what we added after the results of Voice came out at CROI. We're doing real-time PK. So it's not really exactly real-time, but this is incredibly innovative. And what happens is, so a participant comes in after they've been using product for 4 weeks. We take a blood sample. We rush this blood sample from across the world to Craig Hendricks' lab in Baltimore. They assess whether tenofovir is present or absent in plasma. That's then fed back to the site. So when the participant comes back at the end of 4 weeks, this information can be fed back to the participant in the context of a data convergence interview. So here the site staff look at the diary, the CASI, the product returns, and also the real-time PK, and in a very collaborative way with the participant, find out the best assessment of their adherence during that time. This, we think, gives us the best way, really, to assess actual product use during the period of the study. So let's go on to the implementation of 017, which is the next slide. Here we have the timelines. Protocol development started in September of 2011. There then followed a number of community consultations in which the protocol was really presented to the community in the at the site where 017 is going to be conducted. And as was a very collaborative and iterative process, the protocol was changed based on feedback from the community. Once we felt that we had the best protocol possible, it was presented to the Division of AIDS for assessment. And then after they agreed, we had version 1.0 in July of 2012. Next slide. These studies are fantastically complicated. There are many, many moving parts. And we have to ensure agreement by all parties. So we reached a clinical trial agreement by July of 2013, and then very rapidly turned around and trained the sites on the protocol, and then the sites were then activated. And you can see Fenway was first deactivated in September of 2013, followed by San Francisco, then Pittsburgh, San Juan, Chiang Mai, Lima, Cape Town, and Bangkok in June of 2014. You can see here that I've starred Pittsburgh and Bangkok as the mucosal immunology subset sites. Next slide, please. So this is where we are. This is 017 activity as of the 2nd of February of this year. And the winners, if you like, the sites who have completed the study are shown in magenta, both the Fenway and the San Juan sites. You can see that we are getting close to the goal. We have almost two-thirds of the participants of 017 who have completed the study. And you'll see all here also that the enrolled number is 195 and not 186. That's because, as we know, life happens to everyone, including our very dedicated 017 study participants. And for reasons which are often beyond their control, they move out of town, they get a new job, and we've replaced some participants to maintain the power of the study statistically. So let's go on to the next slide. Here we have the anticipated timeline. So I expect that we completed accrual in November of 2014. Follow-up I expect to be completed by June of 2015. There then will be data cleanup and data lock by October, and then by February 2016, at the very latest, we will have the primary results of this study. Going on to the next slide, which is the rectal microbicide timeline. You can see in red the rectal microbicide phase 1 and phase 2. I put in some green bars here, which I think is probably headily optimistic about the start of a rectal phase 3, both in the phase 3 study review and availability. So that may be optimistic, but the red line, the red arrows are definitely somewhat set in stone. So that really completes where we are in terms of 017. Let me go on to the next slide. And first of all, acknowledge our study participants, who I have to tell you have been splendid in this study. We're delighted with the way that the participants have been committed to 017. I also want to acknowledge funding, of course, from the NIH, and also our collaborators, Gilead Sciences and Conrad. And with that, I will go on to the next slide and thank you, and we'd be delighted to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Ross, for a really beautiful presentation. I also just want to give big props to you and the MTN for all the community engagement you did around this study. It's very uncommon for a phase two to do the level of work you all did with community consultations and activities at each of the sites in each of the countries. It was really quite impressive, and Irma was very happy to be a part of that. So we do have a number of questions. I'm going to start from earlier in your talk, and you said you weren't the super expert on this, but regarding the gene expression discussion, if you could explain a little bit about what upregulation and downregulation actually mean, and what do the numbers that were indicated in that that table, what do those numbers actually refer to?
Right. So this is going to get a little complicated. Tenofovir is a DNA chain terminator. And so the way it works in terms of HIV treatment is as the DNA chain is being created by reverse transcriptase, then tenofovir will come in as an analog and terminate that chain. And so what the downstream implications of that are is that as the cell tries to make something, then it may be terminated in its ability to make that chain, So there will be no gene, there will then be no protein. Now, I'm not sure if I'm explaining that particularly well, but it just means that there will be some genes which will be cut off and not allowed to form proteins, really. This is particularly the case with mitochondria. Remember that when we place tenofovir in the rectum, the concentration of tenofovir is about 100 times that we see in plasma from an oral tablet of tenofovir. So the concentration is much, much higher. The other thing that can happen is that the gene expression may be facilitated. And that can also happen by a mechanism which I don't particularly understand. So, I mean, Ian, you're much more kind of labby than I am. Do you want to add to that?
Thanks, Ross, and thanks for a great presentation. So this is a really, you know, complicated area of science, and we're using a lot of new technologies, very sensitive technologies, and what the clinical relevance is completely unclear. I mean, what we do know, and this is not a surprise to many of us on the call, is in the early days of HIV treatment, some of the drugs we use had what we might call in drug development off-target side effects. And I'm thinking here of lipodystrophy and that kind of problem. And that was probably due to some off-target effect of the drugs in affecting mitochondrial function. So guess what? When you put 100 times the level of drug in the rectum that would be seen if you gave someone an oral tablet, you may see some of these changes. Having said that, what we didn't see was any abnormality in the histology, how the tissue looked. It looked completely healthy. The cells in the tissue looked pretty happy. So we think this is, as Ross said, this is a signal. I think it's important that we follow it up. In the 017 study, we'll be looking at tissue from people who've not had just 1 week of treatment, but they've had 8 weeks of treatment on a daily basis. And so we'll be able to look at these effects again, but also we'll be able to compare it with people who've had 8 weeks of Truvada. So I think it's a work in progress. I don't think it's a safety signal per se. And if you really want to read about it in more detail, I really encourage you to go to the eLife article that Florian has just published, and maybe Jim can circulate it through the channels. But it's rather technical, but I think it puts into context that, you know, this is an observation, and we need to follow up on it.
Thanks, Ian and Ross, and I will look for that article, and I will send it through the list. We have a number of questions, if we can make the answers brief so we can get to Ian's remarks. Can you explain quickly what we know about how microbicides affect the microbiome, especially since these are being administered in the GI tract?
Yeah, so we looked at the microbiome in the previous phase 1 studies, and you know, first of all, it's an incredibly complicated thing to look at. Sharon Hillier's lab is doing the microbiology for us as part of MTN Core. And although there was some upregulation and downregulation of bacteria, there was no clear strong signal or something that we considered would be a detrimental signal for the bugs that we actually looked at.
And just to quickly chime in, I don't know who asked that question, but microbiome is a technical term and implies really gene sequencing of bacteria, and that's where you can look at hundreds and thousands of bacteria, that's many of which you can't culture. What we did was semi-quantitative culture. This is where you actually culture the bugs. So that's quite a selective process, and as Ross said, we saw no real major shift. This is something the FDA likes us to do. I think in future studies we may try and do microbiome, but that's for another day.
Thanks. We have a couple of questions regarding transgender women participation in 017. Regarding the results that are coming in, responses that are coming in from both gay men and men who have sex with men and trans women on acceptability and adherence to the various regimens, will that data be disaggregated so we will have a sense for any differences between the groups?
You know, that's something which will be done in a post hoc analysis after everything is completed. One thing I will say is that I think we have the benefit in 017 of having 15 transgender participants in study, which I think is very high for this relatively small study. And so it would give us the opportunity to actually tease that data out and see what's working, what's not working within that community.
Thank you. Were there any participants in 017 who were in serodiscordant relationships?
That's something which it was not an exclusion criteria. So certainly participants who are in serodiscordant relationships could come into 017. I don't have that data. So again, that will be available when the study is complete.
Great. So someone made a suggestion. I know, you know, because of adherence issues, 017 added in the real-time PK monitoring.
Yep.
Was there any consideration of having a site do directly observe therapy?
Yeah, you know, that's something which we have thought of, and actually in a rectal microbicide study which is coming down the pike, MTN-026, that is, again, it's a phase one study of dapivirine. That's exactly what we'll be doing. We didn't think that it would be logistically possible to do that for this study, given that participants would be on study for such a long time.
Great. In your initial look at kind of the data that's coming in, have you seen any common barriers to acceptability, anything that's kind of rising to the top that is, you know, that people are noting in terms of their acceptability with one or more of their regimens?
Unfortunately, we don't yet have that data.
Great. Is there data on intracellular half-lives of the drug in rectal tissue?
That I will on to Ian.
Yeah, and those data are available from previous studies. For those who are interested in this kind of work, that's been published in some detail by Craig Hendricks and Nicola Harmon Richardson, that group. So you can look at the tenofovir, the tenofovir metabolites. You know, the short answer is obviously it does have quite a long half-life in tissue. Probably need to do more work looking at, you know, the decay characteristics and how much residual antiviral activity you have, but that's another topic.
Thank you. And really quickly, and then we're going to move to Ian's remarks because we want to talk about the future of rectal microbicide research. Seeing that many gay men and men who have sex with men use enemas in advance of having receptive anal sex, how was enema use measured and controlled for in this study?
So we, in the previous studies, we were very keen to have our participants avoid that. As this is a phase two study, I was keen to make this as real life as possible. So we were very permissive for any kind of perisexual activity, including enema use. All of that is captured on case report forms, and will be part of the data that we have when the study is complete. So we will be able to look at perisexual activity with enema use in the context of using these drugs. The only thing which we disallowed was the use of any product using ninoxynil 9.
Thanks, Ross, and thanks, everyone, for the really great questions. Ross is going to hang out until the end of this call, so if there are further questions, we will direct them to him. Now I would like to turn the floor over to Ian McGowan, the co-principal investigator of the Microbicide Trials Network and one of the leading rectal microbicide champions on the planet. Ian?
Hey, thanks very much, Jim, and hi, everyone. So really, I just thought I'd take a few minutes just to wrap up by sort of back to looking a little bit over the fence towards the future. And hopefully, forgive me, I'm in the rather gorgeous Delta Lounge at LaGuardia. So if you hear planes landing, that's what it's all about. Anyway, so, you know, as Jim said, we really are living in a different world. When some of us began to, you know, lobby, as it were, for microbicides, rectal microbicides, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I can't say we were really terribly welcome guests at the table of microbicide development. But fortunately, and due to the efforts of people like Jim and Irma and the advocacy groups and perhaps ourselves, that has really completely changed. There's really now a huge momentum to develop safe and effective rectal microbicides. I think multiple research groups are including the development of rectal products in their pipelines. And in fact, there's almost a need now to, you know, really critically look at the portfolio and see what we should move forward. So, you know, in that context, as Ross has said in his great presentation, you know, we are going to have data from 017, probably by the end of this year, in fact. And traditionally in drug development, end of phase two, you look towards phase three. So really, the question I've been pondering, along with others, is what is the way forward? And really, I think, you know, I do believe there's a very important role for rectal microbicide. But at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge there's some very, you know, exciting data emerging about oral PrEP and Truvada. I think, as everyone on this call knows, that at CROI, there will be data presented from the EPA, Gay, and Proud studies. Both of those were stopped prematurely for efficacy. We're very used in our world stopping studies for lack of efficacy, but these, by virtue of the fact they were stopped for efficacy, this means they had a very strong efficacy signal. So I think we've got more and more data accumulating, particularly here in MSM and trans populations, that if you can pop a pill, it'll probably work extremely well. So do we need rectal microbicides? And I think we have to be honest, that will be a question that will be asked, and I think we have to, you know, have some clear answers about that. I would argue that in prevention, just like many other aspects of human life, people like choices, and I think they probably would want choices in terms of their prevention options, and therefore I think we should definitely move forward with this. But another question is tenofovir the right molecule? That might seem a strange idea. We've been talking about tenofovir all morning, but in fact, tenofovir is probably one of the less potent molecules in the microbicide war chest. The NNRTI drugs like dapivirine are in fact much more potent. And we are starting a phase one study of a dapivirine gel. The other issue is this the right formulation? I think if any of you have heard me or Ross or others who talks about rectal microbicide, one of the primary rationales we present is that most people use a lubricant for same sex. And therefore, why not use a medicated product? And I think the reality is that in all our studies to date, we haven't actually used it in that way. We've given people applicators. We've asked them to use the applicators to insert the product. And really, is that how it would be used in the real world? Is that how we'd want to use it in a phase three trial? So that's a legitimate question. The other thing is, how often are we going to use it? In our studies to date, we've tended to look at daily use. Would we use that in phase three, or would we want a more like a BAT regimen? Important question. Haven't got much data there. But let's just say we do decide on the basis of data emerging from 017, we want to move to phase three. Then in the era of oral Truvada being licensed for PrEP, at least in the US, what kind of a phase three trial could we design? Could we still really do a classical placebo-controlled trial? Could we do it, but only if we added oral PrEP to the backbone of prevention package? Or could we do a head-on comparison between Truvada and, let's say, rectal tenofovir, a classical non-inferiority design? These are some huge operational, logistical, and financial and scientific questions that the field needs to think about. Another issue is, where would we do the study? With vaginal microbicides, we've always done these studies in sub-Saharan Africa. That's the place where the highest incidence is and where we can do these studies. But as everyone knows on this call, and it's a sad reality, we have high incident MSM populations around the world in every continent. So should this just be a US study, or should it be a US and global, or should there be more than one study? Some very important questions. So what are we going to do about all of this? Well, we are going to convene a series of three meetings over the next month or two. The first one is going to be on the 18th and 19th of February, and we're going to bring together a bunch of domestic and international clinical trial design experts in prevention, together with community advocates, the FDA, and ethicists. And we're really going to unpack the different designs and try and come forward with a list of what might actually be feasible. We'll then take those designs to actually a formal ethics consultation, which will happen on the 13th of March. And we're bringing together US, Thai, Latin American, and Sub-Saharan African ethicists to talk about, you know, what is ethically feasible and appropriate for their regions of the world. And then finally, the day after that meeting, we'll bring the ethicists back to meet with the community. And by community, I mean both domestic and international community stakeholders to say, look, if we were to do this, this is what we think makes sense and what we think is ethically appropriate. What do you think? And get feedback there. So I think by the end of that process, we'll have a very clear idea of what a phase three program might look like. So, you know, what are the possible outcomes of all this sort of activity? Well, one is, the optimistic one is we move forward with a phase three study. Another option is that perhaps we do some additional work to bolster the portfolio before we go to phase three. And one example of that is doing a study where we look at direct digital insertion of gel compared to applicator insertion to see if we could actually just give people, you know, a bottle of the product and to use it as you would use any other lubricant. That's the study which we are planning to do. Should we do that before we move to phase three? Another issue is, would we say, and I didn't mention it, but in these meetings, we will actually present in a confidential sort of way interim analysis of all the data from 017. So this is going to include the behavioral, the PK, the safety, everything. If at the end of all of that, we think, well, maybe tenofovir is not a drug to move forward, then I think our obligation is to fast-track development of something like dapivirine gel, a more potent molecule, a molecule which may not have some of the issues associated with tenofovir that we saw with the microarray, but that's just another possibility. And that study, as Ross said, is going to happen later in the year in Pittsburgh and Birmingham, Alabama. So what are the implications of timelines? Well, honestly, I think if we move directly to phase three following completion of 017, you're probably talking about the possibility of beginning a study probably, I think, early in 2017, realistically. If we had to do additional studies, we might add another year to that timeline. And if we were to fast-track dapivirine gel, I think, you know, we would be looking more like perhaps the first quarter of 2019, something like that. Those are just guesses. But clearly the fastest way to the clinic is through a direct phase three tenofovir study. All the other things will involve some delays. At the same time, just to finish, there is a space out there where other things are happening, which are very exciting. Kenneth Palmer in the University of Louisville has a U19 to develop a griffithin rectal gel. That would be the first non-classical antiretroviral product. That's something we should talk about at a future meeting. That's exciting. And also, Craig Hendricks has a U19 to look at enemas. We mentioned this earlier, but not just as a sort of a preparatory activity, but actually the vehicle for actually delivering the product. He's going to look at that with tenofovir, but also in some extremely potent tenofovir prodrugs like tenofovir phenamide or CMX-157 from Chimerix. The goal in this study is to have a tenofovir derivative enema you could take and provide protection for a week. That's ambitious, and it's in the discovery phase, but it's out there. So I'm going to stop there because I may have stimulated some questions, but I think the next month or two, I think, will really help us unpack whether we think the time is here to try and move forward with a phase three tenofovir study and what that might look like. But there are other contingency plans to make sure that we keep the field vibrant and moving forward to give people options. So, Jim, back to you.
Thank you, Ian. And, yes, very stimulating indeed. And since I neglected to do this after Ross's talk, and I'm sorry, we should allow for some verbal questions if there are any. If you have a question that you would like to ask verbally, you will need to press *7 to unmute your phone and identify yourself and ask your question. So that's pressing *7 to unmute your phone. And while you're thinking about what that question might be, I'll get to that after we answer one more that's come into the chat. And this is another scientific question regarding the long-term use of tenofovir on mucosa. Is there any risk of mitochondrial toxicity? And are there any studies of long-term use side effects of tenofovir on mucosa, whether it's anal or vaginal?
Yes, thanks, Octavio. Actually, 017 will be able to provide that answer. Anyway, as I mentioned, 007 showed what was potentially at least a kind of an up and down regulation of mitochondrial genes, and after 7 days of rectal tenofovir, what we'll find out in this study is what would happen, what's going to happen after 4 weeks and also after 8 weeks. So this is really going to be the study which answers that question.
And if I can just add in, Jim, I don't think we should be too dogmatic about 007 data sets. We're also looking at this kind of systems biology, gene array work in two other studies, which you know about, Project Gel and Charm One. And I have to say the preliminary look at the data are more confusing than clear. So, you know, it's Florian's work was very clear. But I think, you know, other studies have made it a little less clear. So we need more data.
Thanks much. I'm going to pause to see if anyone wants to ask a verbal question briefly and concisely. Pausing for a moment. One more moment. Okay, you still have another chance. I have a question coming in from Anna. And this is regarding a trial design for phase 3. Has there been any consideration of using a run-in trial to identify participants who willingly volunteer and indicate that they would choose not to use PrEP, even if it was offered as part of a prevention backbone, as you discussed? This could be an important factor in terms of doing a trial that isn't so large that it can be funded but still meet ethical requirements. Any thoughts on that?
Well, maybe I can just answer that. I mean, we're literally having, as you know, a 1.5-day meeting to unpack every possible design possibility. And I think there's kind of adaptive, in the sense of adapting, you know, the design to accommodate run-ins or, you know, use of placebo to see if people will use product or, you know, the proud type design with deferred access. They'll all be on the table. And I really want people to go for it and unpack the strengths and weaknesses of different, you know, design strategies. The bottom line is, I think we'll have one attempt to do a phase 3, and we want to get it right. These are huge investments, I mean, in the region of $75 to $100 million to do a phase 3. So it behoves us to really be careful about the design.
Indeed, and we know that the protocol for yes, go ahead.
This is Mari Tennyson, and I'm from Cape Town. I have one question that I would like to ask you, and this is regarding retention and follow-up of your patients. What strategies have you used to implement retention and follow-up effectively?
Thank you for your question.
Ross, do you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, it's something which I think, again, I really take my hat off to the sites for this. The policy at the beginning of 017, as you perhaps may know, is that we wanted the right participants for this study, and the right participants were participants who were invested in the study as much as we were, and who could without the unforeseen conduct all of the study procedures. And so we spent a bit of time. I mean, oftentimes the sites would bring participants in for educational for meetings before even considering screening. There was often two steps to the screening procedure in order to make sure there was absolute clarity around the protocol and what was required, but also as a means of assessing the participants' adherence to study visits. So I think we were incredibly lucky with the participants that we've got, and we certainly aim for 95% retention in MTN studies. We have achieved that, and I think it's due to the investment in the participant, the participant's investment obviously, but also the investment by the site staff into the participant. Don't forget, we're contacting these participants every single day. They are really truly part of the team when they're on study, and I think that sense of involvement has actually paid dividends in terms of the retention that we're seeing for this study. It's been excellent.
I think just one quick comment to that, because I suspect our colleague in South Africa was alluding to maybe phase 3 as well. Phase 3 trial designs, the components are much less complex than the phase 2 study. And when we look at the VOICE study, our MTN study, we had great investigators, great participants. They came to every visit. Retention was almost universal. The vast majority didn't use the product. That was the problem. But we did not have a problem with retention. MTN and our trial sites around the world are excellent at that. So that's, in my list of concerns, that's not at the top.
So in thinking more about a phase three, there's a question about community engagement in the protocol writing process. How will the community be engaged in developing the actual protocol for a phase three if it's decided to move forward?
Well, you know, I think we're showing our cards already. I mean, we're having a global community stakeholder meeting in D.C. in March, even before we have a concept written. You don't get much more engagement than that, as you know. And then once we have a concept, we'll probably take it to domestic and international sites for, you know, country-specific engagement activity. I think that's
so. You would agree. Consider doing
hallmark.
Something similar to 017.
Oh, we have to, absolutely. Yes.
So a quick question, and I know we're just about a little bit over our time, but there's another question in the chat regarding formulation. So, seeing as this individual says, you know, flatulence isn't anyone's favorite problem, whether you're a top or a bottom, is improving the formulation continuing? What's happening with the formulation of tenofovir gel?
So in terms of evolution, I think we're done. It will be very interesting to see if flatulence is an issue with this formulation in 017. Clearly, it's not an ideal effect of any product which will be used rectally. And as I mentioned before, it may not necessarily be due to the formulation. It may be actually due to the actual drug. And if that's the case, then I'm not sure how much can actually be done. In fact, nothing can be done if it's actually the tenofovir. But I think we will get... remember, these phase one studies were really small, really, really small. So I think we will get a much better idea when we see the baseline data, when we see the data of use at the end of 017, to see if this actually is a real side effect or if it was something which just was apparent in the earlier studies.
Another just quick comment is that, you know, all these patients, participants in our phase one studies, they all have multiple flexible sigmoidoscopies. And during that procedure, when you cut your biopsy, you actually inflate the rectum with a lot of So what actually we may be seeing here is to some extent, you know, just people reporting, you know, adverse events related to the procedure, not the product. The good thing in 017 is we have, you know, a minority, 36 of the 195 patients getting the procedure, the rest not. So we'll really, as Ross said, be able to unpack whether this is a molecule-specific problem, a formulation, or maybe related procedure.
Thank you so much. And if people will bear with us for another minute, I just want to open up the call one more time to see if there is a verbal question. You need to make it quick and do it immediately. So press *7 to unmute your phone. If you would like to get in one last question before we close out this call. Okay. Well, I want to thank, is that someone joining us?
No, it's the fire alarm going off in the Delta Lounge.
Oh, that's Ian. Okay, Ian is responsible for the fire alarm. oh, my God. What's happening in the Delta Lounge? Anyhow.
I don't know. It's all for my credit.
I hope you're safe. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Thank you for participating. Thank you for the great questions. Thank you, Ross and Ian, for a very stimulating discussion. And as ever, thanks to our partners at AVAX who make all of this happen with us at IRMA. The slides and a recording are going to be made available to everybody. If you have further questions, I'll be happy to pass them along to the presenters. You can email me through IRMA or through my email address, which is jpickett@aidschicago.org. Other than that, thank you for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your morning, afternoon, or evening, depending on where you are, and we will be in touch again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Very much.